WBUR supporters include IDC, hosting an open house for sales, IT, and interactive products and services on August 17th in Framingham and 3 Speen Street. Details on the web at idc.com. And Mercury Computer Systems, producing high-performance stream computing solutions for today's image and signal processing challenges. www.mc.com/jobs. It's 79 degrees in the city at just about 8 o'clock. Stay tuned for The Connection with Christopher Lydon. From Boston University, this is 90.9 WBUR-FM Boston and 1240 WBUR-AM West Yarmouth. Also broadcasting on 91.5 WSDH Sandwich and 90.3 WCCT Harwich. WBUR, Boston, Cape Cod, and the Islands.
From WBUR Boston and PRI, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The Internet began without a hint or promise of its commercial potential. It was a byproduct of the Cold War, developed originally to be a backup communication system for Defense Department scientists and academics in the event of nuclear catastrophe. Early on, when some lawyers tried to capitalize on the network and advertise their services, people tried to take their site away. The humble history of the Internet is part of its charm now, but in the crush of e-commerce and e-advertising, many people fear that the promise of online democracy is quickly giving way to the reality of online television. Public space is harder and harder to find on the Internet as the dot-coms squeeze out the dot-orgs, they say. It may just be time for a new and improved Internet or a second one. Is the Internet public, private, or something in between? The Internet's loss of innocence is next on The Connection. First, this news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Buford Furrow is facing both state and federal murder charges, and the Los Angeles District Attorney says he will seek the death penalty. Prosecutors say Furrow has confessed to wounding 5 people at a Jewish community center on Tuesday and to killing a U.S. postal worker a short time later. A federal official says Furrow told the FBI the postal worker was not white and he worked for the federal government. A federal magistrate has refused bail for Furrow, who appeared in court today in Los Angeles. Attorney General Janet Reno says the L.A. shootings appear to have been motivated by hate, and she called once again for curbs on gun ownership. NPR's Barbara Bradley reports.
Reno noted that the apparent nature of the crime, by a man who appears to hold white supremacist views, suggests it is a hate crime, and she called for tougher hate crime legislation. But she noted that the culture of violence is facilitated by the sheer number of guns in America.
If Toronto has 100 gun homicides from 92 to 96, and Chicago, a city of equal size, has over 3,000 gun homicides in the same period, we see alternatives, and we know that guns do not have to fuel violence in a community.
Reno said she would continue to push for legislative fixes requiring gun licensing, a cooling down period before one buys a gun and actually walks away with it, and a limit on the number of handguns a person can buy. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
Federal disaster officials will spend the night number crunching, assessing damage from the most destructive tornado in Utah history. Yesterday's tornado killed one person and injured dozens. Meanwhile, volunteers and disaster crews are cleaning up debris left by the storm. Kat Snow of member station KUER reports.
The evidence of a 100-mile-per-hour twister is all over the street. In dangling gutters, torn roofs, and residential sidewalks forced out of alignment and propped together at angles, neighbors and city crews have worked nonstop, cutting and hauling trees and cleaning out debris. Public safety officials say 300 homes were damaged in the storm, 40 of them severely. Federal disaster officials are assessing costs, which the Salt Lake City mayor estimates will be in the tens of millions of dollars. The twister also shredded a pavilion of display booths containing thousands of dollars worth of outdoor products set up for the annual trade show of the Outdoor Retailers Association. For NPR News, I'm Kat Snow in Salt Lake City.
Former Democratic fundraiser John Wong pleaded guilty to conspiracy for violating campaign finance laws today and was sentenced to a year probation and a $10,000 fine. The plea and sentence had been expected but were delayed by an effort to have Wong testify before Congress. His lawyer says he will do so if called. This is NPR News.
Good evening, I'm Steve Sine in Boston. Governor Paul Cellucci has slashed funding on road and bridge projects by about a third for next year. The governor cut about $100 million out of the bill approved by the legislature to spend this year's budget surplus. Cellucci did approve $450 million for the Big Dig and to widen Route 3 from Burlington to the New Hampshire line. A new survey shows income in New England is going up. The Labor Department reports the average income for the region is just over $34,000 annually as of 1997. That's an increase of 5.5% from the previous year. Salaries shot up the most in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New Hampshire. A longtime resident of Hamilton who refused to vacate his foreclosed estate was sentenced to 4 months in prison today. John Sweeney was convicted of contempt of court. U.S. Marshals removed him from his estate last year after he defaulted on a loan. Sweeney says the bank swindled him. Today in Boston, the prison sentence was delayed pending an appeal. Tonight's a good night for a stargazing if the clouds part a little bit. The Perseid meteor showers are expected to put on a show starting around 10 o'clock tonight. The meteorites falling to Earth are actually particles coming loose from the tail of a comet that touches Earth's atmosphere. In sports, the Red Sox are off tonight. They start a series against Seattle tomorrow night at Fenway. We're funded by you, our listeners, and CyberCash, providing technologies and services for thousands of e-commerce businesses. The Harvard University Extension School, offering open access to Harvard University since 1909. 617-496-5000, on the web at extension.harvard.edu. And Hutchins, Wheeler, and Dittmar, counselors at law, over 150 years of dedication and service to its clients. Partly cloudy skies tonight and muggy too, with some patchy fog and lows of 65 to 70 degrees.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. There's a kind of war being fought over the Internet as an idea and as a communications medium. It's being claimed equally now by business interests and by the advocates of freedom and democracy and by Al Gore, too. There's the fight over the browsers, the fight over the networks, the fight over the cable and phone lines, and all those First Amendment fights. Zoe Baird, who was Bill Clinton's one-time nominee for Attorney General, is concerned now about the growing lack of public space on the Internet. As the head of the Markle Foundation, Zoe Baird has allocated $100 million over the next 3 years to carve out more public space on the Internet for talk about government policy, about health care, about children's media. She says the forces that are driving the Internet's growth now won't deliver much of that. Our guest, Jonathan Zittrain, says that the Internet has lost its innocence in a way. Lots of people are clamoring to revive the state of bliss in which the Internet was created. Lots of others are trying to get rich off the way it is now. Connection listeners, do you worry about the direction that the Internet is headed? Do you worry about commercialism? Do you think freedom and democracy could still prevail? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK to make the Internet connection with Jonathan Zittrain from the Berkman Center for Internet and Democracy at the Harvard Law School. We're talking about what everybody talks about these days, the Internet, but what are the threats from it? What are the threats to it? Jonathan Zittrain, welcome back. Give us the overview.
Well, one way to start thinking about the debate is to actually look to how the net came about and, in many important ways, how it's still evolving. And it's a little bit of a white elephant. It's important. It's big. It's in the room. But for some reason, people often don't see it. By that, I mean the Internet started in people's spare time or as research grants that people did. You know, the government would give money but not be particularly directive about what to do with the money or what kind of net they wanted to see. And then it would be created, and often the way it would be created one direction or another would be what people who were writing it just wanted for their own personal use. Gee, wouldn't it be nice if I could address an email to someone anywhere in the world and give that email address out and then others could use it? Gee, wouldn't it be nice was the way that many of the features started rather than a
focus. Gee, it is. I mean, we think of it as a kind of backup sort of fail-safe communications network. I still don't know where the damn thing is. Should we know? Do we have to know? Would it be help? Would it help to know?
Well, we don't know exactly where it is, nor do we know exactly how much it costs. Even the peering arrangements to this day are incredibly informal as to, at the base backbone level, who's paying for what. At some point, that'll have to be resolved.
We don't have a secretary of the internet in the president's cabinet. We don't have, an internet regulatory commission either. There's a real mystery about which gnome under which dome of MIT is actually running this. Maybe we'll come back to that.
Yes. And in fact, if you were to ask somebody, is the internet public or private, they'd have a hard time answering the question, because in one sense, it's not exactly public. It's not run by a government, and there's not some minister in some cabinet that says this is the way it should be next. It's also not private in the sense that it's not proprietary. It's not owned by any one company or even a collection of companies that decide where to take it next. So if it's not public and it's not private, what is it? And I don't know, I call it, as I think about it, blank. It's in some third category of thing, which, again, is quite surprising to imagine. The group most responsible at the lowest level of Internet protocols for developing it is called the Internet Engineering Task Force, the IETF. The IETF is not incorporated. It has no particular headquarters. It has no president. Indeed, its motto is, we reject kings, presidents, and voting. We believe in rough consensus and running code. Of course, that's its motto if you ask people associated with it, but there was no vote taken to formally adopt that because, after all, they reject voting. And through this structure, actual internet protocols get developed. The email that you and I send every day, SMTP, Simple Mail Transfer Protocol, came out of the IETF through its very informal, not private because it's not held within a company, nor not public process.
Is it managed? Would anybody want to argue that it's well managed? Or is it sort of like, God's creation, the universe itself? It runs happily on its own.
Well, it's certainly not spontaneous generation. And if you say, is it well managed? Well, it's a success, at least in its first phase. It's a booming, wild success. So in that sense, it's been well managed. On the other hand, the kinds of decisions that have had to have been made to manage it have been largely in the realm of the technical. How do we make packets work? And we believe in rough consensus and running code. So you get the engineers defined as that group of people which are willing to gather in a room and not be bored to tears when you talk about packets. You try to see if they can agree on how a packet should work. And if they're in the room, the way you figure it out is you ask them to hum. They'll actually, at an IETF meeting, call for a hum. And it turns out you can't hum particularly loudly, even if you feel passionately about something. So if there's a hum of consensus around something, then maybe it's adopted. And then when they're offline, when they're not at the meeting, they have mailing lists. And again, these are open lists. Anybody can join it. Moderated by people who step forward and earn respect among this group of people, and they have some power to manage the lists even. So if somebody is disruptive, they may give you your walking papers and tell you, sorry, you're not welcome anymore. And you might come in under a different email address. So it's been protected by being a backwater, and the problem is it's no longer a backwater.
Exactly. I mean, you have the space that techies, geeks, if I may, have created out of nothing, and it's suddenly the target of a huge and incredible multi-billion dollar gold rush. Nobody's quite sure who owns it, whether it's public or private space. What is the effect in this whole context of the billions of dollars wanting and investing themselves in the internet today?
There are a couple distinct effects. One effect is, whatever you think about Microsoft, certainly any young entrepreneur has got to envy the fact that they are the toll booth over a major portion of the information highway. They are the people that, for personal computing platforms, if you want an operating system, you go to Microsoft, you fork over your money, and you get it. And that's what's made Bill Gates the richest man in the world by far. When I interned at Microsoft in 1990, I think he was worth between $4 and $6 billion. He's now worth almost $100 billion in just a few short years. Since then.
You kept your stock options, I trust, Jonathan?
I released them in 1993, so I'm not as wealthy as I might otherwise have been, but no regrets.
What's the effect of all those private investments, private armies, so to speak, in the public space?
Well, one effect is that there might be a desire to proprietize what we've been describing as this not public, not private internet space. Somebody might say, look, Microsoft managed to be the big bear that runs operating systems for PCs. Where's the big bear that runs networks? You know, couldn't there be a networks person that could then make tons of money just straddling the highway and taking a toll because they have some intellectual property interest in the standard. So one thing to watch for is to see if people are trying to proprietize the standards that right now aren't owned by anybody. There's no tax collected by anybody to run on the Internet. It didn't have to be that way. When I started out on what you might call the Internet, it was on CompuServe in 1982. CompuServe is a proprietary network. They owned the network end-to-end, or leased it out. They owned the standards by which things were negotiated over the network. And for all we knew, the Internet of today could have just been a big CompuServe. It just could have been everybody has a CompuServe account. You don't worry where you're at. You just have your alias, and that would be that. And in that case, you'd have a Microsoft counterpart for the net. It just didn't turn out that way. CompuServe, in some sense, fizzled, and you ended up with this open net juxtaposed with the closed operating system.
Let's talk open and closed. I barely knew what the Internet was, and I wasn't on it when I first started reading about, in Wired magazine, Mitch Kapor, then of Lotus, or just recently out of Lotus, worrying about keeping the Internet democratic, keeping it a Jeffersonian sort of space of yeoman, small-d Democrats, public conversation. Nowadays, you cannot turn, I mean, of course, there's infinite value on that, in that space, but you can't really turn it on without seeing somebody to add for something.
Right.
These sort of billboards on the center field wall of our public stadiums and stuff. What is it? What is the meaning of all that? What is the real, where does the argument actually happen on this question of keeping it democratic?
Well, keeping it democratic unfolds in a couple ways. One way that you've hinted at is a kind of paternalistic worry among some people that like to see deliberation, interesting conversation take place and see it as an important component of a functioning democracy.
Right.
They say if you end up distracting people with ads and shopping, you basically turn the Internet into one big shopping mall, then you've lost an opportunity. In a way, it harkens back to television when people originally
right.
thought, boy, what opportunity here for town meetings.
I was going to say, so town meeting or versus the shopping mall idea.
Right, and it turns out, you go on to your local cable outlet and you've got 99 channels, and as it expands, it just gives you more pay-per-view. It does not give you more town meetings, and to be sure, there isn't entirely a whole lot of demand that we know of to simply watch lots of town meetings on the television. So then you might ask the same question on the Internet, particularly when there's an opportunity not just to have to watch people in their chamber deliberating, but to participate in the deliberations oneself. And it's something of a circular problem, because what we were talking about before was the fabric of the Internet. The fabric hasn't developed to support, as well as it might, interesting conversation among people and having that conversation come to closure in some way. The deliberation then comes to a vote or some taking of consensus. And without that fabric, you don't then have easy means of doing it. And the fabric, of course, that money is pouring into is commerce platforms, advertising platforms, things like that. So there's a sense, not to speak for Mitch Kapor, but there's a sense of a missed opportunity here.
When Zoe Baird worries about a public space being squeezed out by commercial.coms, just what's her worry, and much less what she's going to do about it?
Well, here's what I would tell her worry should be.
Okay. Zoe Baird, are you listening?
Here's your worry. The worry is that given that any particular site one visits on the Internet, particularly among the popular ones, is going to be privately held and run. That's part of the glory of it, a wonderful entrepreneurial crush, a diversity of different sites, each privately managed. You worry that to the extent that those sites become hosts for conversations and deliberations, they actually have an opportunity to exercise control, so-called private armies. And we've had even recently a couple interesting cases develop where people with an interesting, whether you disagree with it or not, but an interesting message are told, sorry, take it elsewhere, no shirt, no shoes, no service, get out of our corner of the net. And it turns out they get bounced around from one corner of the net to the next. That might be Jews for Jesus, which just recently had an advertising contract for banner ads canceled on Yahoo under pressure from B'nai B'rith, told Jews for Jesus, that's not something that you, Yahoo, should be seeming to endorse. And Yahoo says, all right, we're a rational profit maximizer. There's enough hassle over this. We'll dump them. We'll find somebody else to give us a banner ad. Or GeoCities, which has been known when it finds any website it doesn't like, says, look, we're giving you free website service, but it's under these conditions, and one of the conditions is we evict you whenever we feel like it. Now, so far, we haven't really felt the sting of that, because when you get evicted, you can generally go somewhere else. There's somebody that may host you at some point. But as we get into an internet that is more and more concentrated, that sees a shakeout happening with only a few portals that people look at, you then start having to wonder about the power that these private hosters like GeoCities might wield over people.
Is there a case to be made for Internet 2, sort of something vaguely like public broadcasting, a home for civic Internet, real-time meeting stuff?
I think there is. And the way to make the case for it is to say, is there a way that we can gather people together, not in a completely undifferentiated space? To me, when I think about an internet commons or a public space, it's not anybody can say anything and it's just a big server that is the server of last resort if nobody else will host you, but rather a space that has a sense of self-governance, where one of the first questions taken up in the public space is, how shall we govern ourselves? It's Lincoln's questions at Gettysburg. Are we capable of governing ourselves? And having the people who use the space, whether as authors or as browsers, people who then come in and read what is posted there, having them have a sense of ownership collectively of it. And there really isn't a place like that on the net yet.
Let's go to the calls. Connectionist News, we all live half our lives and a lot of our fantasy lives on the Internet nowadays, and we expect to live our 21st century on the Internet. Is it going to be there for what you want to get out of it? In what way is the Internet itself threatening? In what way is it threatened? 1-800-423-8255 makes the Internet connection with Jonathan Zittrain. James is calling from his car.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well, James.
I wanted to kind of debunk a couple of, or maybe clarify a couple of things. I was lucky enough to be on the Internet, or actually the ARPANET, since 1978.
Oh.
So I've kind of seen the whole long history, and I was also lucky enough to be involved with some of the early pioneers in making use of the ARPANET, like Roger Duffy at MIT, who ran some of the major mailing lists in the early 80s. And really, back then, it was a pretty boring enterprise. There wasn't much you could do with it. The argument that people don't want it to be commercial, I think, is a little backward. In fact, what's made it successful has really been the fact that there is commercial content out there. There's this historical belief that people don't want it to be commercial based on the fact that when we first started to see commercial content on the net, it was on Usenet, the net news, and back at the time it ran, as they were fond of saying, when you posted a message, posting this message may cost hundreds or thousands of dollars. So having somebody sending commercial content out on that cost a lot of people who weren't interested in the content a lot of money. What we have today is a very bandwidth-rich environment where, people who post commercial content by and large are paying for the privilege of posting that. This whole idea of having this private area that's going to be protected for this democratic speech is great, but I think the reality is, like anything else on the Internet, the proof is in how many people you can actually draw to it. People come to the commercial space because they're interested in the commercial space.
Mm-hmm. James, maybe you know too much about this thing, but stand by.
Well,
Jonathan.
This is where something like the Markle Foundation can come in, because part of the dynamics of the Internet is that supply creates demand, not the other way around, although to be sure it's a loop of sorts. And surely in a market environment then one wouldn't object to Markle saying, all right, we're going to take our hard-raised money and just give it away for this purpose. And if we build it and no one comes, well, shame on us. I guess there really isn't interest in cable access for the Internet in that extra channel we may build. But the proof will be in the pudding, and somebody may have to make the initial investment as a matter of the commons to do it. And I also just want to clarify, it's not we don't want the Internet to be commercial. I don't take that to be the argument of people who worry about this sort of stuff. Rather, we don't want it to be entirely commercial. And again, I look to television as having converged to a kind of a homogeneity, just kind of you go from one channel to the next and it all looks pretty much the same. And we don't want to end up with that, a surfeit of content, but all pretty much the same and pretty much mainstreamed.
Right, well, the argument is that actually it's a much more democratic medium than it used to be. I mean, these days, anybody with, a fairly small investment of money, a couple hundred dollars a year tops, can get their content out, and if you're savvy enough, as has been proven by a lot of independent sites that have become popular, you can get your message out. You know, back, you know, even 10 years ago, you had to be a pretty rare bird to be able to get access and to be able to get your content out.
Absolutely. It is much more democratized in the sense that you described today. One of the things, though, that I worry about is that tomorrow may not look much like today, and in fact may look a lot more like it did in the past. An example that you no doubt are very familiar with is quality of service. People talk about quality of service on the Internet, and what does that mean? That means that businesses and others who have the money to pay for it want to make sure that they can put that money down and have packets move at a guaranteed rate, so that if they're sending video over the net, they know that it will get there. I mean, imagine telemedicine trying to do surgery when you don't have this guaranteed quality of service. Somebody says, gee, I guess there was network traffic over Omaha. You know, you didn't get the feed you needed to complete the surgery. But as that gets developed, it not only has a technical dimension, but a political one, because when you get an Internet with multiple tracks to it, then you inevitably, I think reasonably, ask who may be relegated to the lower track of the bridge and who is going to be on the upper track, and are people on the upper track ever going to deign, even if they have the option, to jump down to the lower track and see what's going on. So what we take for granted is the democracy of today. I don't think we can take for granted tomorrow, and at least we want to ask the question, are there values that we want to make sure, policy values, public values, are enshrined in the Internet of tomorrow?
But just be very particular. James, thank you for your call. Jonathan Citrine, just how would you do it? And what would be your minimum program?
Well, this is, I suppose, another call to Zoe Baird and others of like mind to her, which is we have to start creating structures to deliberate about the public policy values that need to be enshrined in the technical parameters. And when I think about the fall from innocence, the fact that, yes, it was a boring place way back when, it wasn't necessarily fun, but it was one for which technical excellence was what drove the creation of the standards, and for which now, given the way the politics are into it, another example is identification, a desire to have it be known who is sending out packets on the Internet. And in the early versions, it wasn't that important. Why would people lie? Why would you care that much? And of course, now there's plenty of reason, both for commercial interests to care, they want to deliver pizzas to somebody that really ordered them, and for government to care. They want to find the person to put out bomb-making materials, pornography, gambling information, you name it. And enshrining that in the technical standards is a fight that we need to collectively have, even though it's not going to take place necessarily in the U.S. Congress. So creating that forum for deliberation about these issues would be a noble task, and one that may well require some money from a place like Markle.
It's interesting. I mean, structures of deliberation and a kind of form of self-governance. It's amazing that we know so little about how it runs. 1-800-423-8255, the Internet connection. Daniel is calling from his car.
Yes.
Hello, Daniel.
Yes, I wondered whether there might be something useful in thinking about how the development of the Internet might be possibly compared to the development of private and public land use in the United States in particular over the last couple hundred years. How the Internet really represents a kind of a new dimension of space, a new frontier that we're carving out in with technology, but nonetheless appears to be bigger than the sum of the parts that people first envisioned for it, whether there isn't some lessons, aren't some lessons to be learned from that, from what has gone on, and what we might be able to do
Daniel, what would you take to be the lessons of the fights over public land?
The inspiration that hit me was there might be a comparison. The actual lessons I'm not quite so clear about, except that clearly today where...
I mean, are you a Jim Watt sort of clear-cutting in federal forest kind of guy, or save it for the next 10 generations guy?
No, I'm much more the latter. For sure. If there's anything we can do to preserve the access to this resource for everyone, certainly the better. This does not necessarily mean that commercial interests don't have a place, but I'm certainly the most for that.
Well,
yeah.
Jonathan Zittrain.
I think there's a good comparison there, and what might be most instructive about it are a couple of the points of divergence as you compare land use and so-called internet use. And the first is that at least with land use, you had one thing going for you, which was once you've defined the land, pretty much starting from right of king, you know whose authority it is as to what can be done with the land. And part of the battle of land use is the battle between the person who owns it, the private party, and the government, which always is trying to reserve some rights to say, no, no, you can't put a nuclear power plant there even though you own it. And on the internet, you don't have that king that's the ultimate arbiter, ultimate authority that says, yeah, of course, at the end of the day, it's the federal government's land, and if they decide they want to do X with it, you know, it's the government, and maybe they got to pay you compensation, but that's the end of the story. There isn't as clear a line of authority and legitimacy at the end of the day to say what ought to be done with a given parcel of net land. A second point of differentiation is, unlike physical land, there seems to always be an opportunity to expand the territory of the net, to actually create more land or spectrum, as it were, so that scarcities may be somewhat artificial. And a good example there is domain names as we know them. .com is very full. .net is very full. There is no .biz. But at this point, creating .biz is a lot more difficult than it was to create .com and .net, not because of the technical elements involved, but because of the commercial and regulatory elements involved, with trademark people saying, don't you dare create .biz without being sure that IBM gets IBM.biz instead of Irving B. Moskowitz. And entrepreneurs saying, wait, if you create .biz, I want to be the person to make a ton of money on each domain name, registering the people that want a name under .biz. And these are things that have pushed the technical community, which never had to answer the questions of ultimate authority, into having to be a little clearer about who actually gets to run the show.
Daniel, thank you for joining us. 1-800-423-8255 makes the fight over the internet connection. Barry is on the line.
Yeah, I would like to take a somewhat contrary view to what Jonathan is advancing. In fact, I would argue from a libertarian point of view that we want to impose and try to seek, embed no values into the process of the internet development. I want to celebrate its very chaos, its very directionless, almost predictionless future, which I think is really far more compelling to me than having a group of Washingtonian think tankers sit around, or Cambridge think tankers sit around and figure out which democratic values to enshrine in whatever architecture, access, or whatever they, however they seek to sort of collectivize the internet. I mean, it is so large right now and serves so much utility for so many people in so many myriad different ways that I think at one level it's entirely futile to try to in any way intellectualize and create values around that process. And number two, I think that, you know, at a commercial level, let there be rent seekers. Let everybody try to make their money in any way they can, provided, you know, provided they're not, you know, ripping people off, I suppose. But let people try, and let people try in any way they reasonably can to have that opportunity.
Barry, you make a good point. I want to give Jonathan a chance to respond on behalf of the think tankers of the world before the break.
This is a good argument. It says it ain't broke, don't fix it. What do we need? A bunch of top-down governance from know-nothings inside the Beltway, or academics who don't know anything either outside the Beltway, trying to say what ought to be done with it.
There's the question. Let's answer it after the break, Jonathan. We're talking about the internet and a whole lot of fights over this kind of miraculous, accidental, public, but now private space. Where's it going? What's threatening the beauty of the internet so far? This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Anderson Consulting.